providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And as promised in these last two segments, we are going to shift our focus a little bit more towards the resource sector as we are chatting with Jeff Christian, managing partner at the CPM Group. Now, Jeff, just to kick us off here, broadly, I'm curious to hear what institutions, what large money managers that use the CPM Group for your research in the resource sector, which metals they're looking at. Where have you seen interest from some of these larger potential investors in the space?
We've had a lot of interest this year. And it's a well, I'll talk about the institutions in a second, but the first thing to address your question, it's across metals. There's a lot of interest in gold and platinum group metals, and to a lesser extent, silver. And I think that reflects silver's byproduct nature, for it. But we're also seeing a tremendous amount of interest in critical metals, strategic metals, and energy metals. So, you know, we do research on high purity manganese sulfate that goes into lithium ion batteries. We do work on lithium and cobalt, nickel and copper, the energy transition metals. And then we do work on specialty metals like molybdenum and tantalum, which is used in semiconductors. And we're actually about to roll out and start introducing work on niobium, which is important in semiconductors and electronics as well. And what we're finding is a lot of institutional investors interested in strategic metals, critical metals, and energy metals. And there's this feeling that a lot of the information they're getting needs to be scrubbed and studied much more closely and carefully, that they shouldn't necessarily rely on the marketing hype that they've been hearing. And you're seeing that, for example, in the broader market, too, where people are starting to say, you know, some of these projections that we've seen about how fast electric vehicles are going to come along are unrealistic. And we need to sort of think about how fast electric vehicles will come along, where the electricity is going to come from, where the metals are going to come from, and things like that. So we're seeing that. So the first thing is, yeah, you're seeing increased investor interest, institutional investor interest in specialty metals, energy metals, as well as precious metals. They haven't abandoned precious metals. But the other thing that I wanted to mention is you're seeing an acceleration in a shift that we've been watching for years, which is big traditional institutional investment management companies. The biggest ones are thriving, you know, the Black Rocks, and such are thriving and they're growing, but others are not doing as well. They're under a lot of cost pressure and performance pressure. Where you're seeing a tremendous amount of growth is private equity companies and family offices and private equity companies that are kind of hidden because they are wholly owned affiliates of industrial companies that are privately owned by families or you know, groups of people. And you're really seeing, you know, there's been a distinct shift, which we started warning about back in 2001, 2002, but it's accelerated with a shift away from publicly listed companies to privately listed companies and away from public mainstream institutional investment company management companies toward these private equity shops and family offices.
Well, Jeff, just along those lines of thinking, when you think about the specialty metals, the critical minerals, the energy transition minerals, a lot of them are either what we used to call base metals, or they are more niche. And so some of the companies that exist in the space, there's very few of them that cover the specialty metals, for example. There's very few deposits that even make sense economically. So I guess it brings up the question of what you mentioned there at the end. Should some of these companies really be private companies rather than public companies? And can people really trust some of the marketing hype that you get out of the industry about these projections when the companies, in a sense, are price takers, not price makers?
Yeah, you know, exactly. And these are very specialized metals. They have extreme, you know, across commodities, if you're a publicly listed mining company, you have regulations that require you to disclose information, and you have an economic incentive, which is that you're trying to stimulate investors buying your shares. But if you are a secondary refiner of a metal, or if you're a fabricator, there are no regulations that say you have to tell people how much metal you're refining and recovering from scrap, or how much metal you're using in your products. And there's a economic incentive to not say that. You know, the last thing an auto company wants to say is we're shifting back toward platinum away from palladium, because they'll have investors buying platinum and selling palladium and skewing the prices in a way that is not in their interest, right? And it's secretive, and it's across commodities. I mean, even in oil and gas, despite what people think, you know, every country that measures its gas oil demand actually measures it as a shadow of demand. It's like, you know, well, how much are we producing and importing less? How much are we exporting and changes in inventories? And that is our apparent demand. And that's true across all these commodities. So you have extremely opaque markets and extremely asymmetrical markets. And as you said, in the case of many of these metals, byproduct metals are not a lot of deposits. So it's very difficult for an institutional investor to say, well, is this a good investment? And, you know, when somebody comes to them and they say, here's my confidential information memorandum, I'm looking to raise $500 million to develop a mine in vanadium or niobium or tantalum or lithium or whatever, they say, okay, where do I get independent verification? And it's very difficult, you know. And, you know, quite frankly, we had an unpleasant situation where somebody that was trying to raise a lot of money in one metal has been we've been their advisor for 15 years, you know. And one of the companies that is thinking about investing in them gave our research to a company that's trying to compete with us, you know, and said, hey, is this accurate? So this company that had no information to speak of on this particular metal market all of a sudden has all of our information that we've developed over the last 15 years. Thank you very much. You know, but that's the state of play in these markets. They're very small, they're very opaque, and they're very asymmetrical in that some people know a lot and a lot of people know very little. And there's a lot of guessing that goes on as to what supply and demand are and what it's going to be in 5, 10, 20 years from now. And that makes it very difficult for an investor to say, oh, okay, I want to invest in a mine that has an initial mine life of 10 years and a probable mine life of 50 years that is going to be making commodities, metals, that are going to be critical to the energy transition over the next 50 years. Just the level of uncertainty and the lack of concrete information that's reliable is really daunting. And we're seeing that, because we're seeing a steady stream of private equity shops, family offices, and institutional investors coming along and saying, hey, you got to help us here, because people are telling us we should be investing in, you know, vanadium, manganese, and molybdenum or tantalum, and help us make sense of it.
Yeah, fair enough, though, right, Jeff? It's hard enough to predict what's going to happen in the next 3 to 6 months, let alone 20, 30 years out. And that's what makes investing in mines difficult. But with what sounds like a lot of interest from large institutions and then these private equity and family offices, is there a pool of capital that you could see on the investment side that enters this market and leads to not just higher metals prices, but actually filters down into the companies?
Well, I think it goes the other way around in many of these markets. It goes into the companies and increases supply, which could actually have the effect of reducing future price increases by increasing supply to meet future demand. But yes, there's an enormous pool of private money that is looking to allocate itself to useful investments. And they have focused, some of them have focused on raw materials and metals that are going to be required for technological changes in the future. So it's there. And I have to say, look, you know, going back to the 70s, when I started in this business, it's always been, this is what I've always wanted. I like opaque markets where I can develop a strategic advantage by knowing more than the general investing public. I mean, that's been my modus operandi since 1978. So I, to some extent, I don't mind it. And to some extent, it's great, because what I'm finding is that private equity shops are coming along and saying, we understand that a lot of what you hear about these markets in public is not necessarily accurate. Talk to us. You know, and that's what we do.
Well, Jeff, I think another interesting point is not just the pool of capital that's possibly waiting to invest in these sectors if they understand it better, but there also is a pool of capital coming into these sectors from manufacturing and from governments. If we look at the U.S. and Canada, they've been taking strategic positions of lithium companies and nickel companies, and people assume they're going to filter that down into some of the other specialty metals. Rare earths has been another one they've looked at. And the other thing is manufacturers, car companies coming in, battery makers coming in and partnering with end users, with the mining companies to be able to source their material and source it domestically. How do you see that playing into the space?
That's a critical part of it. And it's very interesting because, like, you know, you mentioned the auto industry. We've worked with the auto industry since the early 80s and or late 70s, actually, with electric vehicles in 78. And it's interesting because in the past, when a major auto company wanted a mine developed, it did not invest directly in that mining company or that property. It would go to the institutional investors that were managing their pension fund and saying, hey, you have, you know, X hundreds of billions of dollars of our money under management, and here's a platinum mine or a, you know, tellurium deposit, rich deposit that we think we would love to see it developed. And it would be great if you took just a small portion of our pension fund that you're managing and invest in that company. And you know, throughout the 80s and 90s and aughties and into the teens of this century, that's the way the auto companies and a lot of the electronic companies worked. They didn't take direct investments. But in the last few years, that's changed. And it's changed for a variety of reasons, one of which is the deterioration in the institutional investment market. But there's also been some changes, I think, within the way manufacturing companies manage things, that they're being much more assertive in doing it themselves rather than asking their fund managers to deal with it for them. So that's part and parcel of what we're seeing.
Jeff, do you subscribe to this whole theory of almost a commodity super cycle here, but in a different way because of this green transition and the interest now in some of these smaller metal sectors that are critical and, to Shad's point, are getting support even from governments?
No, you know, when the term commodity super cycle was coined, like around 2005, 2007, we said that was nothing but more than marketing hype. And it still is. If you want to understand what's going on, this is economics 101. And it's interesting because if you look at, like, our, you know, we have 10-year copper projections, supply, demand, and price projections. If you look at our copper demand projections, we don't have it growing sharply over the next 5 years. We have it growing consistently at modest paces. So I think that the commodity super cycle, which has been dusted off in the last couple of years, is just marketing hype. And the reality is that the world needs more commodities. There has been a paucity of investment, and much of the investment has been poorly allocated, so it hasn't done as much as people might like. But I think you're talking about economics 101 here, not some commodity super cycle that is going to take everything higher. We may have talked, like last month, about rare earths. You mentioned rare earths earlier. And, you know, we've been doing some work. You can't get enough rare earths to make all of the motors, magnets for all of the motors and all of the electric vehicles that people say they're going to be building over the next 10, 15 years. So our view is that means that the magnet manufacturers and the motor manufacturers must be looking for an alternative to rare earth magnets. And they are. And they're finding them in these things called iron nitride batteries, not ferrite magnets, iron nitride magnets. And that means that capital that will be deployed into rare earth elements, assuming that the technological issues related to iron nitride magnets get resolved, all of those rare earth investments may not pay out because it may be capital misallocation. You know, those rare earths may not be needed. You may well see that that's in money poorly spent, poorly invested. So I think that that's the kind of stuff that you're watching out for. And that's the kind of questions and answers that institutional investors are coming to us and asking us about.
Well, Jeff, I completely agree that with the commodity space, they're all kind of their own unique value drivers. They're all kind of jostling up and down independent because they could be replaced. There's that substitution risk you just mentioned. There's times where there's a projection that there's a big need and maybe that doesn't play out. But when people talk about the commodity super cycle, somebody like Jeffrey Gundlach has posted a chart, or it was a year or two ago, showing just how undervalued something like the CRB index was, or the equal weighted commodity index even more so, compared to asset prices of equities, U.S. equities or real estate or bonds and other asset classes. And they were making the case that from an asset class standpoint, the commodities had more room to run to the upside and to get back to more of a reversion of the mean. That's the way I've always understood the commodity super cycle. What would you say about that concept, that commodities may be undervalued relative to other assets?
There are a couple things. First off, the reversion to the mean isn't about price reversion. It's about return reversion, that the return on an investment should revert toward some long-term mean return. So it doesn't mean that the price has to rise. It means that the returns have to rise, and that could happen at a lower price. The other thing is, if you look at commodity prices over time, and you can look at specific commodity prices like copper, or you can look at the CRB index or other commodity indices, real prices of commodities tend to decline. And that's because, starting with the Industrial Revolution, technological changes primarily initially are on the supply side of markets. So, you know, you've seen this enormous explosion. And people can look at it and say, oh, look at this tremendous growth of copper demand over the last 150, 200 years, or iron or nickel or gold or silver. There's been this tremendous growth in demand, but there's been an even more dramatic growth in supply. And the result has been that the real price of most commodities has fallen due to technological changes. So the idea that there's a commodity super cycle that's going to take nominal prices higher, well, you can argue that. But when you start talking about real returns and real prices, history suggests that technological change will probably lead to more efficient supply of commodities in the long run and lower real prices. And there's another thing. I mean, people do this stuff, and it's crazy. It's just like you'll see a guy, and he'll say, if you look at silver, it's undervalued relative to everything. You know, silver relative to housing prices, silver relative to food, silver relative to the price of an automobile. You know, the price of silver relative to all of these other assets and goods and services is at a historic low. And they imply that there should be a sharp increase in silver prices to play catch up with the rest of the world. But that ignores the reality of shifting demand and supply conditions. And the reality is that silver prices have never had a good correlation with housing prices or food prices or automobile prices. And there's never been a good correlation. And there's no reason to think that there ought to be a correlation now or in the future. And the reality is that, yeah, we're using less silver per GDP than we used to because we're using other stuff. You know, I sometimes talk about American cordage, like, and don't hold me to the years, but I want to say that in 1890, American Cordage was like the biggest market cap on the American Stock Exchange. And that they made cords, they made rope for tall ships. By 1894, they were bankrupt because no one was building tall ships. They were building steamships. You know, and I'm not saying that silver is going to be obsolete. What I'm saying is that you have to pay attention to the long-term supply trends, long-term demand trends, and you have to have a realistic view of what they mean for the price, because it's quite possible, and it's been proven over the last 200 years of history, that a lot of raw material prices will fall relative to everything else. Look at food prices. You know, people complain, and yes, food prices are rising sharply now, but look at the price of any type of food now compared to 200 years ago. Even though, you know, and what you'll find is that, A, the supply is several hundredfold larger, the consumption is several hundredfold times larger, and the real price is a fraction of what it used to be.
All right, Jeff, before we wrap it up, though, I want you to take a step back, and through all the conversations you have had and all these different metals and commodities we have touched on, which ones do you think have the best setup for investors, whether on the company side or simply just the underlying price?
I like gold, and that's because it's a financial asset more than a commodity. In terms of commodities and companies and prices, I do think that copper is good. What we're seeing right now with the energy transition, cobalt's had its day. Manganese should do better, but it's high purity manganese metal and high purity manganese sulfate. These are chemicals. It's not so much manganese ore. The same is true with nickel. It's not so much nickel metal as nickel, high purity nickel sulfate that's going to really be important. I worry about rare earths. You know, we've tended to tell our clients to avoid rare earths for the last 15, 20 years, and we're continuing to say that. I do like copper. I do like aluminum. I do like titanium. And I like molybdenum, because molybdenum is an interesting one. You need molybdenum for drill pipe for oil and gas. You need molybdenum for the steel in transmission pipes. And you also need molybdenum for things like the towers in windmills and other applications of new energy technology. So molybdenum stands to benefit from both the old energy system and potential future energy systems.
All right, Jeff, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate you taking that time to jump all around to a number of different commodities and resources and share what you're hearing from some of the large institutions and even some of those family offices as well. Everybody, thank you for tuning in to this weekend show. Please be sure to go back through our website, kereport.com, and podcast The KE Report, to listen to all the daily editorials and company updates we recorded throughout the week. And as always, keep in touch with us through email. We love hearing your thoughts on the markets and on our guests. Jeff, everybody, thank you for taking time with us on this weekend. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.